Okay, as you just heard, I'd like to emphasize the impossibility of adequately summarizing what was delivered in this conference on the topic of interventions. So I'm going to try to hit some high points, but this is not an exhaustive list, and the presence or absence of any presentation here should not be viewed necessarily favorably or unfavorably. So the theme of the conference is transcending barriers, creating opportunities. Interventions can do both of these, and some interventions can do both at the same time. So we heard some things on exciting biomedical presentations. We heard a few on improving the basics of screening, treatment, patient recall, and partner services. We don't know all there is to know about those. And then we also heard a number of presentations on positioning public health to address the healthcare landscape in 2016 and beyond. One of the biomedical presentations was one on meningococcal vaccine. In New Zealand, they introduced a meninge vaccine and rolled it out 2004 to 2006. They strived for universal coverage. They reached 80% of those under the age of 15 years and 50% for those 15 to 17. Then the vaccine was no longer routinely administered after 2008, but the tall blue rectangle there shows the time frame in which the vaccine was being rolled out, and underneath it, the lines show gonorrhea rates, and you see that they sort of drop off after 2006. Chlamydia, not so much. So they did a retrospective case control study of the meningococcal vaccine. The persons diagnosed with gonorrhea were cases, and the persons diagnosed with chlamydia in sexual health clinics were the controls. Eligible patients were born between 84 and 1998, and eligible to receive their vaccination during that 2004 to 2008 time frame. They did an unconditional logistic regression to determine difference in proportions vaccinated between cases and controls, and they calculated vaccine effectiveness using 1 minus the odds ratio, and they came up with an adjusted estimate for vaccine effectiveness against gonorrhea of 31%, with a confidence interval that goes from 21 to 40. This is certainly very interesting. It's intriguing. It's the first time we've seen possible evidence of gonorrhea having vulnerability to a vaccine. And my vaccine knowledge has been well exceeded at this point, so we'll move on. Another very interesting presentation was on single-dose oral treatment for gonorrhea. It's a phase 2 trial of a drug called ETX0914. Participants received either a 2,000 or 3,000 milligram single oral dose or a 500 milligram ceftriaxone injection. They were eligible for inclusion if they had signs or symptoms of urogenital gonorrhea, confirmed gonorrhea in the past 14 days, or were a sex partner of a patient with confirmed gonorrhea in the past 14 days. 179 enrolled, 141 had gonorrhea, and here are the microbiological cure rates for these different regimens. 98% for the 2,000 dose, 100% for the 3,000 milligram dose, and then 100% for ceftriaxone, 12% cited adverse events, and that was primarily gastrointestinal. Certainly very intriguing and very promising, since gonorrhea is something we have been worrying about for a very long time, because anything we throw at it, it seems to adapt to, get angry, and overcome. Expedited partner therapy is one of those interventions that is well established in many programs now, and it's promoted for private providers. A couple of studies in New York City provided some information on how that's rolling out. 31% of women who were treated with or treated for chlamydia received EPT in one survey, and there were two methods of EPT administration, by prescription and medication. So they receive a prescription, and they actually receive doses of medication. They did a cascade for those women who received medication. The treatment rate of their partners was 80%. When the index patient took the prescription to the pharmacy, the treatment rate was also 80%. When the prescription was given to the partner, the treatment rate was 74%. And what this suggests is there are relatively high rates, apparently, of partner treatment, regardless of the mode of administration. Another study looked at sentinel surveillance for EPT in New York City. The stars represent the facilities, and the circles represent the neighborhood pharmacies. Red pharmacies participated, blue pharmacies did not. On the surface, these facilities are fairly similar. 112 cases of chlamydia with prescription EPT at one and 114 at the other, but the number of EPT prescriptions they could find when they went looking were not similar at all. 61% for facility one and only one for facility two. Facility 1 uses electronic prescriptions for EPT, and Facility 2 uses paper. The index patient gets an electronic prescription. The partner, they would hand them a paper prescription to take to the partner. And then the policy at Facility 1 is that they do double dose prescriptions, 2,000 milligrams of azithro. So the partner or the patient fills the prescription and gets treatment for both herself and her partner, whereas at the other one, it was a partner-only prescription for a single dose. Now, this just suggests that surveillance of EPT is difficult. Even if the prescriptions are flagged, they're supposed to be in New York. EPT is supposed to be in the body of the prescription. But a double-dose prescription may improve its effectiveness. We've been wondering for a long time about what is going on with public health STD services and STD clinics in particular in the changing healthcare environment. Can we and should we save our STD clinics was a column in STD in 2010. Are safety net sexually transmitted disease clinical and preventive services still needed in a changing healthcare system in 2014? These questions need to continually be asked because the environment in which we operate is continually changing. But as of 2016, the answers appear to still be yes and yes. Another New York City study looking at STD clinic patients and their insurance status. Insurance status is down, uninsured is down in the bottom in green, and you see that about 51% of the male patients and 43% of the female patients were uninsured versus a city average of 14%. Now, what I learned this morning in another presentation, long after the deadline for these slides, is that the uninsured rate may be sharply higher among STD clinic patients. So there may not be that many in New York City overall. 14% is a pretty low rate of uninsurance, but they find their way to the STD clinic. Another study by Chan and colleagues looking at patients in Rhode Island, the insurance rate in Rhode Island is very high, and yet 40% of the patients in the clinic were uninsured versus 4.5% in the state overall. So again, you find that the STD clinics are attracting uninsured patients. This is going back to the poster by Washburn and colleagues looking at STD clinic patients, and they were asked, where would you have gone if the clinic was not available? Well, 15% said they would have gone to the ER. We certainly don't want that to happen. About 12% would have gone to urgent care, and then about 21% say they would have waited, and we don't want that to happen either. So safety net clinics, whether they're dedicated STD clinics or just places where people who don't have a means to pay can go and get immediate confidential services, continue to play an important role. Now, all of this talk about insurance naturally brings up the question of billing. Is it possible for public health to bill for services if patients do have insurance? That could generate some operating revenue. The Chan presentation featured a graph showing the potential revenue that could be gained from billing for operations with the number of patient visits are on the horizontal axis and the income generated is on the vertical. You can bill for lab services only or physician office visits or both. And you can look at the Medicaid prices, which are the lower lines, or the upper lines, which are full sticker price. So there's very definitely some potential here. Now, as an economist, we don't necessarily care who pays the bills. We're concerned about how much the service costs. But program viability can depend very much on who pays the bill. Unfortunately, of those with insurance, only 40% in Rhode Island are willing to use it, and they cite concerns about anonymity. This is something that we've seen before. It is definitely something that we have to deal with if we're going to look at turning a potential revenue source into a real revenue stream. Another study in Denver Health looked at the same question. Patients with insurance, are you willing to use it? Yes, no. 35% said they were not. This is a study of about 2,716 patients. I encourage you to go look at the Mettenbrink study when it is available on the conference website because she provided a detailed breakdown by sex, age, and sexual orientation. And it's very interesting to see who is more likely to refuse to use their insurance. Percentage of young women who are insured on their parents' insurance. This is a study by Lusher and colleagues using the MarketScan database. It's an administrative claims database of privately insured people. It's very large, about up to 40 million people. And the ages of the women go up as you go down in this graph. And starting in 2010, you see that the older ages, there's an increasing trend for them to be insured by their parents, which is what you would expect. That's what the Affordable Care Act provides. But the rest of the story is that women who are on their parents' policies are less likely to receive a reproductive health service. The parents' policy is in teal, and then their own policy is in blue, and young women age 19 are less likely to be tested for chlamydia over the whole time frame studied. This is an administrative database. We have no information about these patients and why they're not getting these services. Are they at lower risk? Do they perceive themselves at lower risk? Or are they concerned about confidentiality? Or all of the above? PrEP is another intervention that is sort of emerging in our programs. It's something that wasn't around in a very real sense a number of years ago. NACHO and CDC did a study of implementation of PrEP in STD clinics. As presented on the first day by Gretchen Weiss and colleagues. And the local health department engagement in PrEP implementation, the 67% there you see at the center right is for those who are in large jurisdictions, and then it tails off to 35% for local health departments in medium jurisdictions and 21% in small, which is probably what you would expect because smaller clinics have fewer staff and fewer staff with specialized skills. We'll talk about that in just a moment. 71% of all the local health departments operated an STD clinic, but 81% of those engaged in PrEP implementation. 57% of health departments had someone they could refer or had a place they could refer patients to for PrEP. 81% of those who were actually engaged in PrEP implementation had such a place. Now, that's PrEP on the supply side, clinics offering the service. PrEP can also be pushed on the demand side, which is where you get patients going in and asking for it. And social media can be used for this. This social media platform, the actual screenshot there is for an HIV testing banner ad, but Grindr surveyed their users and found that 1 in 5 who were on PrEP cited messaging they saw on the platform as having directly impacted their reason to go to their provider and ask about it. So this is definitely something that can be explored. Of course, health departments can try to drive the demand side for services too. This is a screenshot of a site that's meeting the needs of Rhode Island gay, bisexual, and other men who have sex with men. This was a poster shown yesterday by Tom Bertrand and colleagues. They conducted a survey to find out what health information men would want to find online, what would they find most beneficial, and 92% said finding a gay-friendly doctor. That's something that they would like help with. 33% of the respondents of the surveys were not out to their healthcare providers, and 51% felt that it was hard to find a gay-friendly healthcare provider. And this is in a state where the environment is not necessarily particularly MSM-unfriendly, relatively speaking, and yet there are still populations that are finding a hard time doing this. The website traffic, they got about 40,000 page views over 3 years or so. Number one was the page that helps them find a doctor. But then Ask Dr. Phil Chan is a column, and I went through and I looked at that, and many of the questions that people were asking the doctor directly were, how can you help me find a doctor that would be gay-friendly? So this is definitely something that's on their minds. We can meet these needs. And then the second most common site there you see that they're going to on the Mentimeter Rhode Island is the community calendar. That's not necessarily directly health-related, but it is something that they're going to find interesting. It will bring them to the site where they can be exposed to the other things that are available for them on the site. Now, technology is not something that just works on the demand side, it also works on the supply side. We can use small technological interventions to modify our programs and improve their effectiveness. Tiffany Deal and colleagues presented results from a project at McGee Women's Health in Pennsylvania looking at an STD tracker reminder system. So patients were added to the tracker, this is women, after they had a positive chlamydia or gonorrhea test. They were scheduled, ideally, for a repeat test of reinfection in 3 months, and then they were called with and then a follow-up letter if necessary if the appointment was missed. So pre-tracker versus post-tracker, the number who had their test for reinfection within 3 months was 34% before the intervention, 43% after. And at 4 months, it's 47% to 57%. You see that these are substantial increases. And the positivity rates are there in red. And you see that these women, I mean, the reinfection rate was high, and these people should be getting repeat screening. So it's a relatively low-cost intervention that's operating on the provider end to help facilitate them following up with their patients. Another way to improve program effectiveness, going back to the supply side, perhaps, or the demand side, rather, is a platform that was discussed by Dr. Cohen, a reduction in time to treat after implementation of an electronic STI test result delivery through something called HealthVana, which is a patient engagement platform. And basically, the one-sentence summary of what this thing does, as I understood it, was that it delivers the test results directly from the lab to the patient. It doesn't go through the provider. And in a study of patients who were successfully treated, men, the time from test to treatment went from about 12 and a half days to about 10 and a half days, and most of the reduction in time there, you can see at the bottom, is a reduction in the time from test to notify. Now, you can contrast this with the opening plenary looking at the Dean Street Clinic, where they provide text message notification of test results, but they're also modifying their testing procedure to run the test faster. This doesn't really affect anything up until the point the test is run and the lab publishes the results, but then it goes on to notify the patients. So what do we need to know more about? And this should not be considered all-encompassing. This is because when we set research agendas at CDC, we get great groups of people together, and we take a long time to do it. We don't just do it in a week or so. But as I was looking over these presentations, a couple of things struck me. One of the things, it's obvious that we could stand to see more information on how to overcome obstacles to PrEP initiation. Going back to the NACHO survey, the health department cited these obstacles: limited staff capacity, concern about financial access, a number of other things, a lack of awareness. So there are definitely problems there, and they can be overcome. Another presentation by Kulkami and colleagues looking at a PrEP trial implementation in the STD clinics in LA County, they said they identified certain problems. There are obstacles. They have no third-party billing. They don't have financial workers. They don't have staff with experience in patient navigation. And I see Ned's starting to fidget, so I'm going to start talking really fast. It's time. Okay. Well, here, look at this. 95% of those that initiated PrEP, they had problems getting linked somewhere else. And then there's the confidentiality concern thing again. A lot of them, that is something that keeps coming back. And so another thing that we need to know more about is patients who stop PrEP. Are they doing it because their risk is going down? That's kind of what we would anticipate. Or are they having insurance problems and failure to link to a PrEP provider? I didn't see a lot on that. We talk about the importance of retaining people, but once they go off PrEP, is it because their behavior is really going down? That's a critical population that we don't want to lose touch with. And then how to engage at-risk populations. If you're talking about the millennials or Generation Z, I'm not the one who would be providing any information on that, but I know some of you do. And what do we need to know more about your successful interventions? I know that there are, in the delivery of public health, you don't have time to stop and think. And yet I know that there are programs that have things that are working for you on a local level, and this conference provides an ideal platform to share what you've learned, what's worked for you to improve public health overall. I don't have an acknowledgement slide, but I would like to thank all of the presenters who gave me their slides without fail when I asked for them, and also William Pearson, Marion Carter, and Ian Spicknell, who helped me put this together. Thank you.